Hello, this is Healing the Earth Radio, and today I'm interviewing Linda Bazell-Saltzman, who is an eco-psychologist and eco-therapist, and is the founder of the International Association for Eco-Therapy. She's been a psychotherapist in private practice for over 25 years, and she's also a fellow at For the Future, a think tank that deals with sustainability and recovery from consumerism. She is the originator of For the Future Sustainable Small Cities Project, and she teaches classes at Santa Barbara City College on eco-psychology, eco-therapy, and career opportunities in an emerging sustainable society. She and her husband Larry are the founders of the Santa Barbara Organic Garden Club, and they've created an edible backyard food forest on their city lot, growing vegetables, herbs, tasty flowers, and over 60 fruit and nut trees. So Linda, do you think you can please tell us, in your perspective, what eco-psychology and eco-therapy is and what kind of work you're doing right now?
Well, I've been a therapist for about 30 years, and it's only within about the last 10 years that I've really kind of moved in the direction of green psychotherapy, which is just another word for eco-psychotherapy or eco-therapy. And for me, what happened was that I began to get closer to the earth myself. We moved into a suburban area where I was able to work with my husband, and we have built kind of an urban food forest in our yard instead of the usual suburban forest. And we got involved in permaculture, and just doing all of this and gardening and growing our own food and all of that began to change me. And it began, of course, then to change my practice, because I realized that unless we include our relationship with nature in our diagnosis of anyone or trying to figure out what is making people hurt, none of it makes any sense. And once you do include your relationship with the earth as well as human-human relationships, a lot of things make more sense than they did before. At least that's been my experience.
Mm-hmm. I like how you talked about gardening to begin, because I find gardening such a transformative thing.
It really is, and it's only one of many ecotherapies, but I think it's one of the most powerful.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see this human nature split having arisen from, and what do you feel are the main forces today working to propagate it?
Oh, boy. I mean, it certainly has a long history, especially mm-hmm. in Western culture, that we've been sort of, you know, moving up into the sky somewhere and not really realizing that we're part of the earth. And I think that the problem has accelerated, let's say, in the last 50 to 75 years, as we've become more and more industrialized and more corporate, more and more global. All of those factors really remove us from daily connection with the earth, and we literally forget that we're completely part of the earth and dependent on the earth for our day-to-day survival. And one of the ways that this has become most clear to me is in beginning to grow my own food. Because before that, I really was just like everybody else, thinking that food just somehow comes in packages at the supermarket. And it never occurred to me that it actually grew in the ground somewhere or was an animal. And where did it come from, and how did it get shipped here, and how much fossil fuel was involved in making it and shipping it? And I just didn't think about any of that. And somehow growing my own food and eating my own food kind of woke me up to the fact that we are part of the earth. We eat the earth every day. And, of course, the earth eats us and will eat us.
Mm-hmm. I was at a recent talk by a woman talking about biodynamic farming. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about how soil is like the soul of the earth,
yeah,
in a sense. And plants in this, you know, intricate, complex, you know, energetic relationship with the earth are kind of also like the soul of the earth. And by eating locally, we're, in a sense, communing with the spirit of the earth that we live on.
It's true. It really does connect you. And even things like going to the farmer's market, meeting the farmers who grow some of your food, there's a real soul-satisfyingness to a whole natural way of living. And one of my things that I like to work on with clients is what I call lifestyle therapy, which is one of the many ecotherapies. And that really has to do with asking yourself, you know, how am I living every day, and am I living in a way that's natural for me as a person and as a human animal, or am I living in a completely unnatural way, you know, time-stressed, rushing around, all of the things that we all do, And is that affecting my physical and mental health? Because once you begin to ask those questions, you start to realize that a lot of what we call, you know, mental health problems are actually people being driven mad by the way we're living.
Mm-hmm. Understandably so.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'd like to talk a bit about mental illness in our industrial society, because I find it fascinating that using the definitions of various mental illnesses, as described by the American Psychology Association, civilized humans in their relationship to nature fit the criteria of all kinds of forms of psychoses. And I just wonder if you can talk about what it mean, or what does it mean when our various standards of mental illness mean that we're all insane in a sense, and like, what do you try to do with your work to heal this?
Well, I think one of the first ways to heal is to understand that it's not necessarily you.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that you're in a situation that it doesn't fit who the human animal is and what we've evolved to be. So to not blame yourself. I mean, if we think about animals in zoos, for instance, you know, it's only recently that we figured out that if you put a tiger in a cage that's too small, that he will start to behave really strangely after a while. And, in fact, we had a situation like that here where I live in Santa Barbara with our zoo. Our zoo adopted an elderly gorilla named Max. And poor Max had been brought up on concrete in some very too small zoo. So, you know, our zoo rescued him, which was wonderful. And they put him in this lovely situation where he had lots of grass, he had running water, he had two friends they introduced into the cage. What was interesting was that Max really never recovered. Max would sit in his little corner of this new enclosure on a little tiny bit of concrete that was there, and he would sort of shake. I mean, I see us as human beings, many of us are in exactly that situation, that we've been forced for years to live in completely unnatural ways. And is it surprising that we have various symptoms?
Mm-hmm. I think it's entirely understandable. And there's so many different ways where that comes into play, like how this way of life is unnatural, even being surrounded by straight lines and 90-degree angles and mm-hmm. living in rooms that are boxes is really
right.
weird for our consciousness as well.
I always like to remember that we evolved during the Pleistocene and to kind of imagine in my mind what those early bands of humans were like and where they lived and what their environment was and how they were. And it's kind of a touchstone for me. And because there's a deep, deep physical, psychological, and spiritual connection with that way of living, whenever we're in small groups and we're in, you know, in extended family situations and multi-generational and very close to nature, I mean, we feel so good. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's because somewhere our bodies remember that that's who we are.
Mm-hmm. Because I guess industrial, or I guess even civilization itself, has really only been but a blip on our evolutionary scale, I guess.
It is. And it's not that we're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, there's good aspects of this as well, but
mm-hmm.
I think that we can create a new way of being that includes the best of the old and the best of the new. And that's certainly what I know permaculture is about, and we've gotten involved in the whole permaculture thing in our building of our backyard food forest. And, for instance, one of the things we discovered was it was highly satisfying to go out into our food forest, which has 60 fruit trees on a third of an acre, so it's very crowded and foresty. And we would graze for food. And it's like it was kind of a little surprising to both of us how satisfying that felt. Just get up in the morning and wander out and just kind of, you know, graze around, see what's out there, pick a berry here, you know, taste a rose hip over there, just graze through it. Dig up an onion. And it sounds very mundane, but on some deeper level, it's really powerful and it's really healing.
I'd like to hear more about your backyard food forest. If you don't mind sharing with us, like, the process of of creating it and what kind of things you've learned or insights into like your own life in a city through creating that.
Well, when we bought the house, it's a little, what we wanted was a little house on a bit of land, you know, more land than house, in other words, which is the exact opposite, of course, of the all-American dream. People here are building these huge mansions covering every bit of land you can and then having little sort of artificial shrubs around the rest. So we wanted to do the opposite, and the land was really dry and not fertile at all. And gradually we just kept planting and planting and planting, and luckily we did run into these permaculture people when we moved in, and they came and looked and they said, oh, you're building a permaculture food forest. And we said, what's that? And so they helped guide us as we continued to do this. And it, what it really involves is building an ecosystem so that you have your overstory trees, your understory trees, your shrubs. Our next thing we want to put in is coffee and tea, which luckily grow in our area, which are classic sort of understory plants. And the more the plants grew and the more we ate our own food, it really began to transform us. You know, in the beginning, you think you're making the garden, but what happens is the garden starts to make you.
I like that. And I was wondering if you can talk a bit more about your ecotherapy practice or the work you do. And different, like you mentioned a little bit, that gardening is one of the best ecotherapies. Can you talk a bit more about that and other forms you try to get people to do?
Well, another form of ecotherapy is animal-assisted therapy. And that one I kind of stumbled over. You know, we had a dog when I was just beginning my practice. And I was practicing at home. I had a little home office. And it was really interesting to me to watch when people came to the door that, of course, Pookie, who was a small sort of lovable dog, would run up to them and demand attention and wanted to be welcomed and would welcome them. And people would show up at the door either crying or depressed or just listless or whatever their, you know, their state was when they were coming into therapy. And it was amazing that just minutes of contact with this animal, let alone with me, would immediately relax them and put a smile on their face, and they would sit in their chair in my counseling room and pet the dog, and their whole body would just start healing. And then they were able to really share what was going on a deeper level and to really be heard and really listen. And so I always used to joke that that dog, Pookie, was my co-therapist. And, of course, now we've got all kinds of research to show that this really does work. It wasn't just, you know, some kind of accident. That when we're in contact, especially physical contact with animals, that our blood pressure changes and certainly our psychology changes.
I wonder if that would work the same with humans as well. But I guess the thing with dogs is that they're much more, there's not as much social awkwardness if someone would walk in.
Exactly, right, right. I don't think if I climbed into my client's laps that it would have quite the same effect. Might be a little startling. So I think, yeah, it's just animals are just, first of all, they're natural for us, aren't they? Again, coming back to that idea of living naturally. You know, that when you think again of those early bands of people, you realize that they weren't alone. I mean, they had very early, they had their dogs, they had other animals. It's just part of how we are and how we're supposed to be. And when we artificially separate ourselves out in, you know, little cubicles, it's just not the way we're meant to exist.
I'd love to hear some thoughts of yours on how successful you or other people you've seen have been in trying to use that as a reason to increase biodiversity in urban areas, like the need on deeper levels for wilderness and for wild animals and for all kinds of animals to be around us. Because that's what I see is one of the biggest problems with, like in the city I live in, is familiar to you as well, probably, that, you know, most any green space left is usually bought up by a developer as soon as they can, and then there's one less home for wild animals.
Oh, yes. I mean, we're suffering from that here, like everywhere. We've got big fights going on locally, as you probably do, too, to save the last green space, and and it's really an important thing to do. But one thing I learned is that wilderness is not the only place that you can connect with nature. And in fact, most of us get into wilderness so rarely that we really have to focus on nearby nature, which includes even a little tiny patch in front of your apartment building. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. A local park would be great. Anything you can do to connect with that will certainly be healing for you. And then, of course, the idea is that we have to be reciprocal with nature. It's not enough for us to be using nature to heal ourselves. We obviously have to be, reciprocating that with doing everything we can to protect the rest of nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's lots of work to do. I was wondering if we can also... I know you're part of some networks of Earth-based healers who are doing a lot of work on sharing insights and practices into how we can help people through this transition we're in, you know, that is about energy descent and climate change. And I'd love to hear you talk about what you see arising in the international community of eco-psychologists and what kind of things you think are in the works that you're working with other people over the internet and whatnot.
Well, one of the big conversations that's going on now is how fast the Great Turning is going to be. And I'm using Joanna Macy's term, the Great Turning, as we transition from a fossil fuel-based society to a post-fossil fuel-based society. What's that going to look like? And I just read an article today at ecopsychology.org in their Gatherings magazine about, you know, the three groups that are kind of forming. There's the, what they call the boomsters, or the green technofix folks, who think that it's all going to work out really quickly in a positive way with no problem. And then there's the doomsters, who feel like we're all basically screwed. And then there's the evolutionary people, who feel like it's going to be some sort of an evolution. And we're all trying to figure out, in a public health sense, or as I call it, community ecotherapy sense, what our job is as people working in the healing professions to help people make this transition in as smooth a way as possible. Once people really find out what's going on, it is very traumatizing. It's very frightening. People can get depressed. People can get hopeless. People can despair. It's important to move people through that process in such a way that they do have hope, and they also move into the action phase as quickly as they can for our own mental health as well as for the good of the planet, to get into positive solutions. You know, that we do have to stand up against the folks who would like to pave over the planet, but on the other hand, we also have to build the change we want to see. And that's what I've been working on here, in terms of where we have a little group called Sustainable Santa Barbara that's working with the mayor's office, and we're trying to really envision what would this place look like if it were really sustainable, and what steps can we take in that direction.
Mm-hmm. What are some key elements to helping people to take to go through that despair, to reach that hope and that place where they're ready to take action of some kind? Like, what do you see in this group work that you're involved with?
Well, I think the first step is often information, that people are hearing information or they're gathering information and they're realizing that we do have an emergency situation that we're facing. And then I think that kind of thing should never be gone through alone. You know, we're not solitary animals. We are group animals, and we need to be with others also processing the information. I've been part of a simplicity circle for about 7 years now, and even though we were, you know, primarily working on simplifying our lives and, living more naturally in that sense, a lot of what happened as things began to evolve, both politically and ecologically and environmentally in this country and others, of course, we all started going through a lot of emotional pain as we absorbed the information. And if we hadn't had each other to process it with, to have people say, you know, you're right, this is really a problem, and what are we going to do, and just to be able to listen to each other, it's a form of trauma therapy. And any therapist who's been trained in trauma work is going to find they or a very busy person as this begins to move forward. I don't know how you feel, but we have a great concern that there's going to be a lot of disruption as we make these changes.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to be part of somewhat small, but still a community of people who do recognize that there is some really serious stuff going on, and I'm part of a couple of discussion groups who are talking about this once a week at least.
I think that's an important part of community ecotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that so much of this is so different from the mainstream way of thinking, that there's a tendency to think that, oh my God, you know, I'm nuts, or to have other people think you're a bit nuts for even thinking about these subjects or worrying about them. And the support from others is critical. Even in our simplicity circle, we found that was really important because, just speaking personally, my husband and I were driving really old Volvos, which we kind of loved. And, you know, some folks in his family were kind of ashamed of us. Like, why were we continuing to drive old cars and not wanting to buy new cars? What was wrong with us that we were keeping things so simple and not wanting to sort of keep up with the Joneses? And it does take support to go against your own culture that way.
Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah, I remember feeling extremely reassured, and lots of other subtle things happened when I found out about the activist eco-psychologist listserv that you help coordinate. Just to know that there are people out there who are, you know, very intelligent, you know, well-rooted people in their communities who see the same things as I do and my friends do.
Absolutely, and that's been one of the blessings of the Internet, is being able to communicate with other people who get it, you know, who are concerned about the same things. And not to feel so alone. So I hope we don't have to lose the Internet in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there are some talks about that, rumors every now and then.
I know.
And, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the stuff you're involved in on the Internet, like the activist, eco-psychologist listserv I just mentioned, projects like that, and even ways people could get involved with them.
Well, I highly recommend that people go to ecopsychology.org. It's www.ecopsychology.org. And that's a great place to connect up with a lot of exciting things that are happening in the world of ecopsychology. And they also have a blog that you can go and you can read posts and you can comment your own thoughts. And that really, again, that's community, building community. And the listserv has some really excellent people on it who are some of the pioneers in the field of eco-psychology. So if you're studying or if you have questions or anything like that, there's some excellent people that probably will give you answers about where to look or what books to read, that kind of thing. So it's really nice. And I put out an eco-therapy newsletter, and I'm happy to include anyone on my list for that. And you can email me, by the way, at lbazell@aol.com. Let me spell that. It's L for Linda, and then B as in boy, U-Z-Z, or Z-Z-E-L-L, at aol.com. And that newsletter goes out quarterly and just, you know, has ideas, thoughts, activities, stuff people are working on, and people who are psychology students or eco-psychology practitioners or clients working on various issues or just people who are generally interested are part of that group.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent idea. And I think as long as the Internet is up, the best thing to do is use it as much as we can
exactly.
For these kind of purposes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right now I'm working on a new concept, which I call deglobalize the mind.
What's that about?
I'm actually trying to not just relocalize myself, but deglobalize myself. And by that, I don't mean not being on the Internet. I mean that up until now, with cheap fossil fuels being as underpriced as they've been, people have just felt like they could travel anywhere and do anything, and there was going to be no limits on it. But I'm just beginning to really shift my focus onto the place that I live, the land that I live on. And I actually read a wonderful article in the Permaculture Activist magazine recently about viewing the world through the zones, the permaculture zones that you view your home as zone zero, and then zone one is walking distance, and zone two is bicycling distance, and then kind of drawing these concentric circles out from that. And that, of course, is not how we've been living. You know, we've been kind of ignoring our localities and hopping on a plane and going somewhere else. And, of course, creating a lot of problems doing that.
Mm-hmm. And I've always felt that having a relationship with the land we live on is a necessary prerequisite to protecting it and defending it and helping it heal.
Actually, let me recommend another website.
Mm-hmm.
It's www.terrapsych.com. And let me spell that. It's T-E-R-R-A, and I think it's P-S-Y-C-H, terrapsych.com. Mm-hmm. That's a website by Dr. Craig Chalquist, who is an eco-psychology person, an eco-therapy person. And it's about just this, our relationship with land and the earth. And it's a place where people post their own personal experiences of that connection. And some of your listeners might enjoy both reading that and possibly posting something there.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed Craig, actually.
Well, good.
About 8 months ago, I think.
Oh, that's wonderful. And yeah, he's a very special person.
Very intelligent, excellent ideas. And
I
really like his
website. We are in the early stages of co-editing a book on ecotherapy together.
Mm. Nice.
And so we're getting a lot of interesting contributions from people on what exactly this new field of ecotherapy really is.
Mm-hmm. And now that we've talked a bunch about ecotherapy and some of this stuff, can we talk a bit about For the Future?
Oh, sure.
The organization you're a part of, because I think that's a very tangible, practical thing that's going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
On a community-based level. And I know there's a lot of different facets to it, but can you maybe tell us a bit what For the Future is in general and what role you play in that?
Well, For the Future is a think tank, a local think tank, and it deals with issues of sustainability, and it kind of evolved out of our Simplicity Circle. And the senior fellow is Dr. Richard Bruce Anderson, who was a lecturer at UCSB, and part of the Human Futures course over there. And he really was very important to us in the group in helping us learn about what was going on and then make our own personal transitions into, okay, now what do we do about all this? So that's what it's really designed to do. It's at forthefuture.org, by the way, if anybody's interested in learning more about it. But we're really, what we've been focusing on it for the future is this issue of sustainable Santa Barbara. What is a sustainable area or a town? What would it look like? And I came up with the 17 sectors of society, just which are listed on at forthefuture.org. And you can take a look. I think we boiled it down to 8 at some point. And all the different areas of society and what's unsustainable about each one of them, and then how they need to change in order to be sustainable. And I've also used that list with clients of mine. I do a lot of career work with people, career counseling, and I've been able to use those sectors as basically asking people to look at them and find the place on that list where you want to be involved in making a difference, and it may be your next career. Because I think there's a huge amount of work to be done to transform every sector of our current society into something that really works.
I think that's really true. And I think For the Future is really inspiring. And I think you're doing some great stuff there.
It's been really fun for us. I mean, it really is just a group of local people who got together. And through being part of the Simplicity Circle, we just kind of became this entity. And I don't want it to sound any more pompous than it needs to. A think tank is just a group of people who are thinking. So it's something that anybody listening could start as well. And then you can begin to just spread out your ideas and your information into the community and then see what happens with that. We held a one-day conference at Pacifica Graduate Institute, which is here in Santa Barbara. and brought together lots of people, including the mayor and city council people and lots of people throughout the community, just to do a one-day think on what would a sustainable Santa Barbara look like and what is it we're facing. Bruce is an expert on our energy future and our energy issues, so he gave a lot of information about what's happening with particularly fossil fuels. And it kind of blew people's minds, you know. People were going, oh, my God, really? Really? And then, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to have food security? How are we going to have, you know, how are we going to function? How are we going to feed ourselves, take care of everybody?
Excellent questions. I'm always surprised when people don't know about peak oil. I always think I've known about this for a year now, and all my friends are talking about it, but every now and then people really are so blown away by it.
I know. It's actually becoming more and more known. I mean, even President Bush in his State of the Union message admitted we were addicted to oil. That was a huge admission. I mean, I was kind of shocked that he would even say that. I mean, I'm certainly no fan of his. But the fact that it's hitting that level means that it's beginning to break out into mainstream consciousness that we actually do have some sort of a fossil fuel problem.
Mm-hmm. A few more questions to begin wrapping up things. Not right away, but I'm curious to know what gives you the greatest hope and what do you have faith in?
I think that I get the greatest hope from watching people make this transition. I mean, I really am in awe of the courage. I mean, obviously human beings wouldn't have survived as long as we have without tremendous amounts of courage and resourcefulness. And I really love how creative people's minds are and how they really begin to start tackling problems. I mean, I can see it locally. Right now I'm involved with, there's a person here who has a subtropical fruit farm and it's threatened, and suddenly people from all over the community are beginning to come together and say, let's save it. Let's do it. We can do it. And it's that kind of energy that I find really inspiring, and I also, from a therapist point of view, I find it very healthy. That's a healthy response to any kind of a threat, is to come together as a community and then begin to take positive actions, support each other, encourage each other.
Yeah, I think that is, it's always a source of inspiration for me as well.
Yeah.
And I was also wondering, maybe just to wrap things up, I guess, to tie all this together, a lot of stuff we've talked about is to do with community organizations and therapists and psychologists and all kinds of different ways of viewing the world. But I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about what about individual people and things people can do, like even things that when they leave their house and go for a walk to wherever. What do you want people to take with them from this interview as far as, I mean, there's lots of things, but even like something personal and tangible and individual.
Well, one exercise that Dr. Michael Cohen of Project Nature Connect recommends is that you go to a place where there is some nature, other than human nature, and you allow yourself to be attracted by something. He believes we're all connected by web strings, is what he calls them. And just see what it is. What catches your eye? Is it a small flower growing up through the pavement? What is it? But actually to slow yourself down, slow your breathing down, and just take a minute and do that sort of connecting exercise. Just let yourself be there and communicate with whatever nature, whether it's a tree or a flower or an animal, and allow that to go on for just a couple of minutes longer than you might think you want to, and see what happens.